Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is gold so precious to us? It's been used in many parts of the world as a symbol of wealth and power for thousands of years. And while its value fell nearly 30% last year, that decline followed a nearly uninterrupted 12-year run-up in value. Gold mining and trading remain very big businesses even today, despite the fact that, as my guest will tell us, it is a commodity with negligible practical value. Journalist Matthew Hart went all over the world to look into the extraordinary desire that makes this metal precious and the Herculean efforts undertaken to extract it. His new book is called Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal, and he joins us from NPR Studios in New York City. Matthew, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You open the book in South Africa, where literally thousands of people go underground every day to pick away at this 30-inch seam of ore in what amounts to this kind of bizarre underground city. Tell us about that.
Yes. It's an enormous kind of construction, and the way to think of it is a kind of underground metropolis, because not only is it 2.5 feet deep, but it's two and a half miles deep, but it's very, very wide. And it's laced with something like 300 miles of tunnels, a tunnel system longer than the New York City subway. And if you want to get an idea of the sort of depth, think of 10 Empire State Buildings stacked on top of each other. That's the elevator ride you take. And in fact, the elevator ride that I did take to get down there after a sort of introductory meeting, I went down this long corridor and appeared before what they call in the mining world a cage, which is the mine elevator. And I got on there with a number of other people, and 40 people get on this cage, and then it descends 10 feet. And then another 40 get on the level above you, it descends 10 feet again, and another 40 people get on. Once they've got this full package, this three decks with 120 people, they just take the brake off and drop it down the shaft at 46 feet a second. Hmm. And the reason they're in such a hurry is because you have a long way to go.
Yeah.
So that first shaft ride it drops you down a mile and a half. Huh. So the first leg is a mile and a half. You get off the elevator, walk to another one, drop another mile down, and when you get out, you step into basically a pizza oven.
It's 140 degrees without the external cooling that's brought in?
That's right. The rock face is 140 degrees at that depth. There's an effect known as the geothermal gradient that says the deeper you go, the hotter it gets as you get closer and closer to the mantle of the Earth. But they cool it or attempt to cool it. But first of all, on the surface, there's an ice plant that makes 6,000 tons of ice a day. This ice then has salt added to it so that it's converted to a kind of slush or slurry, and it's pumped down these chutes that take it into a very, very deep underground reservoir. And there, giant fans push a current of air across it and down these registers, down these cold air shafts that take the cooled air down to the deepest mining galleries where they're currently mining at 2.5 miles deep. And that changes the ambient temperature to about probably around, well, I guess when I was down, it was about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm. So still fairly warm and, in fact, very, very humid. I mean, our clothes were soaked in minutes. I remember walking along the tunnels and feeling my socks squishing in these big, heavy miner's boots. And you're equipped with the usual mining rig, you know, a helmet and these sort of overalls and miner's boots and a battery, big heavy battery that powers the lamp on your helmet. And also this little aluminum cylinder called a self-rescuer, which is basically a little bag that you can breathe through and that in the event of a collapse will keep you alive for, they say, about 30 minutes. It filters out the most noxious, poisonous gases that you would encounter in the event of an accident. But what it does is remind you, if you need any reminding, of how dangerous the environment is. Because when you when you spend a lot of time digging holes in rock that deep, you have this massive, uncounted thousands upon thousands upon thousands of tons of rock, and you're digging holes in it, the rock wants to close those holes. And sometimes it succeeds. There are tremors underground all the time. 40 a day, we were told. Certainly, I felt some when I was down there.
Let me stop you there, because I love the introductory meeting that you so cavalierly refer to. They give you all this terrifying information that I think would have kept me on the surface forever. But what does an earthquake feel like when you are underground?
Well, it certainly catches your attention. It's just a tremor. Uh-huh. It's a tremor. And you know that it's a spasm, because what it is the rock is like, picture the rock sort of shifting. Mm-hmm. It's shifting. They try to stop this from happening by backfilling the stopes. Stopes are the narrow tunnels that the miners actually hunch into to drill the ore face, which you correctly said at the beginning was 30 inches wide. I mean, this entire city, this huge underground, this the size of the Upper West Side of Manhattan, from 59th Street to 110th Street, that whole swath of city, that's about what the size of the mine, the footprint of the mine would be like. That's all there to attack a 30-inch thick seam of ore. And out of that, they were getting like almost $1 billion a year worth of gold. So the gold price was, and the gold price wasn't at its top then. It was only about $1,500 an ounce. So now, of course, it's backed off a bit. But the tremors are an effect of the earth, of the masses of rock trying to shut down and collapse the tunnels. And sometimes it succeeds with enormous force. In fact, in the 1950s, the United States picked up one collapse on a seismograph. The U.S. government, which monitors the movements of the earth all over the world, they thought that South Africa, the apartheid government at the time, was actually testing a nuclear device underground. That's how big a bang it made. So that's the kind of thing that's drifting through your mind, if you will, as you're making your way through these tunnels.
What does it take, Matthew, to refine gold ore into something that I might want to make into a bracelet?
Well, it takes quite a lot, actually. You have to, depending on the form of the gold, but let's take a standard extraction called carbon in leach. The gold ore comes up, so the ore is contained in rock to a certain ratio, but it's enfolded in rock and in combination with rock. It gets bashed up and broken into pieces, and then it gets fed down this conveyor belt into a large drum. And inside that drum are large balls of steel, and they cannon around in there and pulverize the rock. Then it goes into another drum, and it's the smaller balls of steel are fired at it, and that breaks it up even more. Then this kind of pulverized ore gets fed into a series of tanks filled with a sort of a solution, and cyanide is added to this solution. So cyanide, other kinds of material form this big slurry, and the gold-bearing rock is in there, the particles of ore. What they're trying to do now is fish the tiny particles of ore. You've smashed up the rock, released the ore, but now you've got to find those particles of gold. You've got to get the gold out of all this muck. So they push a kind of like stream. They introduce carbon pellets in downstream and pump them upstream against the flow of this slurry from tank to tank. So what happens is the cyanide helps to free the gold even more from the rock that it's in association with. So now with the cyanide in this sort of muck, basically, mm-hmm. let's call it what it looks like, thin muck, the cyanide helps to liberate the gold, if you will. Then the gold will bond onto that carbon. Later in the process, at the end of the process, they fish out the carbon, they wash it to release the gold, The cyanide gets pumped away into a tailings pond. The gold is recovered. The carbon goes back into the cycle. So that's, in a nutshell, that's one of the methods of extracting gold. There are other ways.
And depending upon where you are in the world and what the environmental standards are, sometimes that tailings pond is sort of dealt with responsibly, and other times it is, I suppose, not too far from the rest of nature in the area.
Well, if you take China, for example, which you were referring to, there are illegal mines. Illegal miners, that's one of their cost benefits.
Hmm.
They don't have to treat the tailings. They can just take the cyanide when they're through with it and pump it straight into the river. They don't care what happens. They're not following any laws. In fact, they're breaking laws just by mining. But there are other more toxic ways to recover gold, too. Mercury, for one. Because an interesting thing, let's go back to the deep mines. An interesting thing about those deep mines in South Africa, in fact, all gold mines in South Africa, but the deep mines make it even more interesting. They're infiltrated with a huge population of thieves. Gold mine theft in South Africa is epidemic. It costs the business $2 billion a year.
Despite the fact that you can be shot on sight if you're caught.
Oh, you absolutely can. It's very, very dangerous. These are desperate people.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get into the deep mines? The deep mines are well-protected environments. So they introduce these miners in by corrupting the security. That's the first line. Corrupt or coerce the security. Because the theft is run by very large and powerful and very violent syndicates. That's what they call criminal organizations in South Africa. Instead of gangs, they say syndicates. And they introduce the miners in. They threaten the guards. They threaten the guards' families, and they wouldn't hesitate to act on those threats. So they get their miners into the mine itself, where they can hide out, because, as I said, there were about 300 miles of tunnels. It's not easy for them to – not difficult, rather, for them to establish a sort of beachhead in there.
Hmm.
And once underground, because there is some difficulty in moving the miners in and out – these thieves in and out of the mines, because there is that difficulty – when they're under there, when they're underground in the mine, in the deep mine, they tend to stay there for a long time. In fact, they stay there for about 3 months at a time.
Wow.
Deprived of sunlight, their skin turns gray. In South Africa, sort of a putty color.
Hmm.
And in South Africa, they call them ghost miners. So not only are they this ghostly population, they go down with their wives and girlfriends. So this whole population that lives underground for like 3 months, maybe 4 months at a time, stealing ore and refining it with the most toxic means you can imagine, mercury being the preferred one. So they're poisoning themselves as well as stealing ore. But they also stay underground and do irreparable damage themselves. Because another thing about these mines is there's a lot of tuberculosis in them. So it's like you might as well be working. Not only are you working in a very hot environment, it feels like you're stepping into a pizza oven, as I said earlier. You're also working in kind of like a petri dish of disease. So it's a very, very risky, dangerous environment. And the people who are under there are desperate people. They can hear you coming a long way underground, and they wouldn't hesitate to shoot you. That's why the security of the mine, once these people are established, won't go near them. They can't be made to go near them, and the police won't go near them.
My guest is journalist Matthew Hart. His new book is called Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking with journalist Matthew Hart, author of the new book Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. You can join us on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So I found every chapter really, really interesting, Matthew. But I have to tell you, your account of the conquistador's quest for gold is worth the price of the entire book. The most amazing thing to me was that the Inca had a ton of gold. They thought it was important, but for them, jade and really beautiful feathers were much more precious.
Yes, that's right. They're not the only culture that felt that way. Gold hasn't always been ranked at the absolute top of the asset menu, as we tend to think. And many gold bugs will tell you that it's a sort of historical imperative that we've always valued it up there. But no, these certain very, very rare parrot feathers and jade were held to be more valuable. Now, the Inca had a lot of gold jewelry. They valued gold, and I think they referred to it as the tears of the sun. And certainly it was a signifier of power, the person of the Inca, because, of course, Inca means both the ruler and the people. The Inca wore gold ornaments. But they didn't have money. So they worked in a system of exchange that involved labor and the state ownership of lands. And so they didn't have money, so there never was that use for gold as a kind of ultimate means of exchange as we had it. However, when I say they made many beautiful objects, we have hardly any of those. There are very few objects remaining to us from this great, vigorous, robust outpouring of, according to the descriptions that the Spaniards themselves made, beautiful, ravishing objects, breathtaking objects that demonstrated an absolute mastery of that metal and metalworking. But we don't have them for the simple reason that the Spaniards took it all, almost every ounce of it, and melted it down right on the spot, stamped it with the Spanish coat of arms, and packed it off to Europe as money. It was the clearest case in history of a culture being basically smelted before your eyes. Every signifier, everything that said what they valued, the sort of delight they took in the world around them, their ability to capture a kind of spirit in these beautiful objects, erased for all time, never to be captured again. Those little yamas and figures like that may be in the ring some of us are wearing. They may be in a gold bar in your local bank. We don't know. They're gone forever.
How did Pizarro and his men come to kidnap the Inca king Atahualpa and essentially hold him for ransom?
Well, it's an astonishing story, isn't it? Because they arrived at a very lucky time. They arrived at a time of civil war. Now, of course, the Spaniards are a very small force, but they do have armor. They have Toledo steel, swords, breastplates, lances. This is kind of the 16th century's weapon of mass destruction because it's far stronger than anything the Inca have. However, the Inca had enormous numbers. When Pizarro arrived at the town of Cajamarca, the Inca, who had just was as I say in the midst of civil war, was encamped in Cajamarca with an army of 80,000. That wasn't his whole army, so he was in this huge force of 80,000 men under arms. When the Spaniards came through that pass, it took their breath away. It's a testament, after all, to their courage that they kept going, or perhaps to their greed and foolhardiness, or the fact that they had. What else were they going to do once they were that far? But at any rate, they marched on and set themselves up in the town with his permission. There, we now know that the Inca thought he could use them against his enemies. He was going to enlist them and use them and probably kill them after.
And they had horses in addition to weapons that the Inca did not have.
Horses, which impressed the Inca hugely, and they also wanted those. Mm-hmm. So they had about 60 horses. And so 60 of them were mounted and about 100 on foot, roughly in there. I think 168 is the total force. They go and they have some cannon. So they set themselves up in the town of Cajamarca and invite the Inca to visit them. Well, to cut a long story short, he does go and visit them. He approaches across the plain, not with his whole army of 80,000, but he has a small force of about 8,000, lightly armed. But of course, it's very light armor. It's copper, wood, and sort of padded cloth. So it's armor that was good enough to protect soldiers from the weapons that they had themselves and that they were used to encountering in their fights. But the Spaniards have something very, very much more serious. At any rate, the Inca stops halfway. The Spaniards are afraid he's not going to come. They send out saying, please come. We really want you to come today. We want to greet you and give you gifts. Finally, the Inca comes. The Inca and his force come into this very enclosed space where the Spaniards are in hiding. As soon as the Inca are all assembled in this square, the Spaniards fire cannon into their midst and then charge out from hiding on their horseback. A terrible sight. They polish their armor so that it would make this gleaming apparition, this huge machine-like force and with the sun gleaming on their armor. They had rattles fastened to their horses. The horses themselves were enormous war horses. So this all came charging out into the Inca ranks, and they just slaughtered them. They cut them down. They cut their arms off. They cut the Inca's noblemen down. Finally, they captured the Inca. They had him as their prisoner, and with the Inca as their prisoner, they had effectively the keys to do with whatever they wanted with the entire empire, a 3,000-mile empire that ran from, you know, one end of the Andes to the other, practically. This very advanced civilization with roads far better than anything in Europe, and a kind of like a magical kingdom, really. You can imagine how beautiful it must have looked to the Spaniards. At any rate, they, with the Inca, who could still rule and whose word would be obeyed unquestioningly, even though he was a captive, because he was also a god, with the Inca, they had the keys to the, they basically had the gold, which is what they wanted.
And they were given a room full, like stacked so high that you could put your arms up over your head, and that's how high it went.
Yes, the Inca knew that they wanted gold, that they were obsessed with gold, though they didn't. He didn't quite understand why. He didn't quite get why, but he knew they wanted it. So he made the offer. In this room where they had them held captive, he said, I'll fill it to the height of my upstretched arm with gold. You can have all that gold if you'll let me go. And they agreed that they would ransom him and let him go for the gold. But of course, they never had any intention of letting him go. They filled that room. They sent the couriers went out throughout the empire gathering gold, and there was a lot of it. Because not only did the Inca live in a palace in the royal city, the imperial city of Cuzco, but the dead Incas, his predecessors in the line of kings, they all had their own palace too. A dead Inca was kept in his own palace with a full suite of retainers and all kinds of gold and gold ornaments, gold objects, a gold fountain in one case, huge doors made of gold, gold tablets. It was a colossal stash, and the Spaniards carted it all back to Cajamarca and stuffed it in the furnace.
How much gold is in the world today outside of, you know, natural deposits?
Well, it's a very good question because, in fact, there's a very, very small amount of gold. When you consider that we've been mining it for 6,000 years, something that was only recently discovered, all the gold in the world, all the gold ever mined in all of human history in that 6,000 years would cover a tennis court to a depth of about 30 feet.
Wow.
Another way of describing it is a couple of big swimming pools full of gold. That's the whole lot. But we trade it. We trade $20 trillion worth of gold a year. So we trade it back and forth and back and forth. We trade about 2.5 times, probably 3 times the value of all the gold ever mined. 3 times that value is traded in a single year.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Matthew Hart about his book, Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. Let's go on the phone now to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hey, greetings. He sort of just got to my question. In looking at the total volume of gold, if I remember right, Croesus was the king that first came up with the coin. And if I remember right, the idea was that it couldn't rust, and you could bury it in your backyard and leave it for a century or so, and it would still retain its honest weight. But and that was why it was valuable. But the idea that there, even Croesus thousands of years ago, knew that there was not enough tonnage to go around if the population was increasing, then there was never going to be enough to go around because there simply wasn't enough tonnage. And with that in mind, have there been other forms of transactions that have compensated for that? I'm kind of wondering why these politicians today, especially the Tea Party types, they seem to really love gold, but if there's never been enough to go around, then why do they seem to want to go back to it?
Thanks for your call.
Well, of course, that's a very good question, because you're talking about a return to the gold standard, and that's something that's very dear to gold bugs' hearts.
We moved off in 1971, right?
Sorry?
Excuse me. We moved off the gold standard in 1971.
Yes, exactly. The gold standard was basically done away with by fiat by the United States in 1971. That was the last country that really was on the gold standard. Other currencies were pegged to the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar was redeemable in gold. At the rate of $35 per ounce. Mm. That was the fixed rate. So what are you going to do if you go back on the gold standard? The thing about the gold standard is you can't increase the money supply unless you have more gold. That's what your caller's just been alluding to. You have to have more gold or you can't have any more money. So in a situation such as the recent one where there was a banking crisis and a general failure of confidence in many assets, which people believed were overpriced, it was a crisis that the government helped solve. Now, I guess people would disagree with whether they did or not, but generally I think that's the view. They helped solve it by increasing the money supply. They injected money into the system. You can't do that if you're on the gold standard.
When we were on the gold standard, were we significantly more stable financially than we are today?
No. The gold standard has contributed to periods of stability in the world, because all the currencies of the major trading countries were tied to gold, so you always knew what you were going to get. And if you were doing financial planning for years ahead, you knew what your dollar was going to be worth. You knew what, if you were owed money, when that money was paid back, you knew exactly what that money was going to be worth. And that did give a certain stability. But there were also periods when there were terrific shortages, or for one reason or another, a country's finances were poor and it lost all its gold. Therefore, its money supply decreased hugely, caused great difficulties, including in the United States. But the story of the end of the gold standard illustrates how dodgy that kind of reliance on gold can be. Because what happened was, after World War II, the United States was far and away the titan of the world, financially as well as militarily. It had something like 75% of all the monetary gold in the world. It had 20,000 tons of gold in its reserve in Fort Knox and elsewhere, Colorado and West Point, but mostly in Fort Knox. 20,000 tons of gold. That's why other countries couldn't be on the gold standard. There wasn't enough gold out there for them to back up their currencies with. So they pegged them to the U.S. dollar. U.S. dollars redeemable in gold. What happened was, as the economy of the world improved after the war, Americans started to get an appetite for the manufacturers of other countries, Japanese electronics, German cars. So they pay U.S. dollars to get these, and U.S. dollars flow out of the country. But meanwhile, The Japanese and the Germans, who are selling things to Americans, aren't buying American products. So there isn't this flow back. What happens is the U.S. dollars are accumulating in offshore accounts. When the central banks of those foreign countries get too many dollars, they just take them back to Washington and say, you know, we don't need these because we're not buying American products. We'll just take the gold.
Hmm.
Gold started to gush out of the U.S. reserve. By the time Nixon came to power, there was 8,000 tons left, 20,000 to 8,000. It had poured out, and Nixon stopped it by saying, guess what? We're going to change the rules. And when you bring your dollar to cash it in, you get another piece of paper. So that was the end of the gold standard.
And 8,000 tons is what remains in Fort Knox and West Point and elsewhere today. That's the U.S. gold supply.
It is the U.S. gold reserve.
Gold reserve, excuse me.
And it's a very important sum. And many people think that it has nothing to do with the U.S. dollar. U.S. dollar is only a fiat currency. In other words, it's only worth a dollar because the government says it's worth a dollar. Well, that's true enough. But in fact, that gold does back up the dollar. The U.S. is still on a kind of gold standard in a way because gold is one of the things that backs up the dollar. It works like this. Dollar bills are known as Federal Reserve notes. That's their actual official legal term.
Mm-hmm.
Federal Reserve notes are issued by the Federal Reserve banks, and the Federal Reserve banks have gold certificates. The gold certificates are backed up by the gold reserve, and the gold certificates are all committed to the support of the currency. So let's say there's $1 trillion of U.S. currency. If you take the gold at its current value, that would back up about a third of the U.S. currency. So, you know, it's just something to think of. Not that they're ever going to sell it or use it for in any way. It sits there, and that's the power of gold. It's illusory. It gets its power from just being there in such a large amount and guarded so heavily.
My guest is journalist Matthew Hart. We're talking about his new book, Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. You can be part of the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Matthew Hart about his new book, Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Matthew, how did London become such a global capital of the gold trade?
Oh, well, the British were big traders, of course. And the first bullion bank opened there. It was opened in the 17th century, early in the 17th century. A trader by the name of Moses Mokata began to specialize in trading bullion. And that's gradually, I guess, because of its trading position, London was the financial center of the world for a very long time. The Bank of England, incredibly important. And the as the financial center of the world, the banking center of the world, and a great the center of a great trading empire, a great seafaring and trading empire, I guess it was natural that the bullion trade developed there as well. And now it's of course the most important bullion market in the world.
And the price of gold from day to day is directly related to events that happen once or twice a day in London.
Yes, exactly. And those are events that are attracting an increasing amount of attention. It's a very secretive business and has been for years, a very sort of arcane business. What happens is this. The gold price is fixed in London. They call it the London fixing by five bullion banks. These are banks with substantial trading operations in bullion. And these five banks have a telephone call twice a day at 10:30 in the morning and at 3:30 in the afternoon, and they fix the price of gold. They don't let anybody else witness this call. It's conducted in secret. You're not allowed to witness it. A reporter can't go and watch it. They're on the phone to their clients, and what they do is they start to try and take the measure of the market for that day. How much gold is there to be sold that day? Who are the big buyers? Of course, they deal in bars. Mm-hmm. So every trade is done in bars of gold. They're not dealing in small amounts. And they out of this process, they find the sort of the what they're doing is taking the pulse of the market, the sense of what the market believes gold to be worth at that moment, and then they fix the price. However, recent research has shown that there's an enormous spike in trading at the time the London Fix phone call is going on. Mm. Not once the price has been set and the market now knows what the new price is, but while the actual telephone call is going on. So pardon us for being suspicious, but one possible conclusion is that somebody who knows what's happening in that phone call is doing all the trading. Because if, for instance, you know that there are more sellers than buyers, well, then you don't like where the price is going. If you know that there are more buyers than sellers out there, then you like the way the price is probably going to be going. So you can make a big bet in the futures. And they do. People have been. The gold price can also be manipulated. That's nothing to do with the London fixing, but it has a lot to do with the kind of people who play at that level and the amount of gold they can dispose of at a certain time. The price can be manipulated by massive selling at a certain time, driving down the price and like that. So it's a hard market to understand. It's only a game for people who really know, really have a kind of line to the inside. Unless, of course, you're taking a long term position in gold.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Chris in Grapevine. Hey, Chris. Hello, Chris. Are you with us?
Oh, I think it should be Fred.
Oh, Fred. I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
That's all right. I studied gold, not at his level, but I studied gold a few years ago when it was much, much lower in price. And I think I'm something of a gold bug when it comes to investing, not necessarily government money, but for long-term and protection against inflation and surges. You can see the price of gold kind of wavers too. During the crises, one place or another, money will pour out of certain investments and go into gold for safety. But my question is, and I'll make it brief, is the Swiss franc still gold-based?
Thanks for your call.
To the best of my knowledge, there's no currency in the world today that's on the gold standard, that's totally backed by gold. The Swiss franc is, there's a lot of gold trading in Switzerland and gold refining. But you're absolutely right when you refer to, you make a very interesting point, and I just want to pick up on that instead, about the gold as a safe haven asset, because that's one of its big value today comes from its use as an investment. And when you describe the safe haven, you're really describing what happened that sent gold up on that price, up on that tremendous rise. Because in 2008, when Lehman Brothers Bank collapsed and the whole financial order of the first world seemed to be kind of teetering on the edge of catastrophe, what happened was money poured into gold. Gold loves a panic. It sucks up money in a panic. And the gold price, which had already been rising for about 4 years, took off like a rocket. That sort of kicked the afterburners on under the gold price. Lehman Brothers collapses, goes into bankruptcy. The gold price takes off. It was about $800 an ounce at the time, so it had already been rising, as I say. And in 3 years, it went from $800 an ounce to almost $1,900 an ounce. 3 years, less than 3 years. Just straight up. That was solely because people wanted to protect themselves, didn't know what was going on, and in the confusion, sort of this, the original hard asset, if you will, this metal that man has believed in as money, and that was money from 635 BC until 1971. So at the core of our idea of value, our notion of value, it just captured all that frightened money, and the gold price ballooned, as we've seen. So that now it's come off quite a bit. It's $1,200 an ounce or something like that today, in around there anyway, in the 1200s. That's still very high, and yet it's come off 35%. So the gold price, I think gold has sort of reached a new plateau in the investment world, probably won't stray too far below where it is now. But yeah, I'm not an investment advisor, not advising anybody to buy gold. I don't own any myself. I'm interested in it for other reasons, because I think gold tells us about the world we're in. It tells us about ourselves, what our feelings are, whether we're panicked or whether we're kind of content with the world.
You took a trip to the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about your experiences there, because there is a huge repository of gold there.
Yes, there is. It's the biggest gold stash in the world, larger than Fort Knox, because at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, they hold not only some of the U.S. reserve, because they have a bit of it there, but they also hold gold reserves for other countries. So it's a much larger stash of gold in New York. And in fact, anyone who wants to visit it can, and I advise it. It's on Maiden Lane and just near Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. You can go online to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and book an appointment. You should go far ahead, because it's very, very popular. When I was there, it was packed with European tourists who had come there to have a look at it. You take an elevator 5 floors below street level. There's this enormous vault, and you get up right there to this big, thick door, and you can peer in and see all these little cages. Each country has its own little cage in the vault. Not so little. And inside those cages, you see stacks of gold bars. And when some countries want to settle their trade imbalances, they bring in this cart and they shuttle some of the gold from sort of, you know, Mexico's cage to Austria's cage or something like that.
You know, when you visit a facility where money is printed, it's sort of a strange experience to see, you know, page upon page of, you know, $100 bills being printed out. What's the emotional experience when you see all that gold? Does it seem abstract to you, or are you able to sort of appreciate how much value is before your eyes?
Well, it's a little hard to, isn't it? But you do know how much it's worth because you know what the gold price is. I'll tell you what the feeling is, though, and what I think a lot of people feel, and that's, what's this all about?
Yeah.
Why is this so valuable? How come this lump of stuff, not good for hardly any practical use, right? It's used in computer chips. They coat the visors of astronauts' helmets with a thin, thin layer of gold because it's very reflective and can protect their eyes from the sun. But other than, you know, things like that, it's really not good for anything except jewelry and sitting in a vault forever, which is where most gold is. And yet we know, because we discovered a tomb in Varna on the Black Sea coast in 1972, a backhoe operator digging a foundation for an apartment building accidentally uncovered a Neolithic tomb. They opened it up, and inside was this treasure of ravishing little gold objects. When the archaeologists had a look at it and carbon dated it, they found out it was 6,000 years old. Neolithic people were wearing gold jewelry 6,000 years ago. So our love affair is a very old one, and I guess you could say that in those days, it was malleable, it didn't corrode, easily shaped into these beautiful little objects, and not many other materials would be like that. Nothing would be as shiny. It must have seemed eternal. But today, we have this incredibly long asset menu. We have all kinds of marvels to look at. Yet something back in our mind makes us still value this ancient asset.
You wrote a book a number of years ago about diamonds, and I'm curious as to how much the two subjects paralleled and the places that you noticed the biggest divergences.
Well, they parallel in that there's a lot of chicanery involved in both of them, which is what, what probably, to my discredit, attracts me. there's a lot of thieves and rascals and mountebanks and, you know, in both those businesses. They're very charming. Diamonds are fascinating. It's a completely fascinating business. But gold is on a whole different planet because gold was money. Gold became, in 635 BC, when the Lydians invented gold money, gold changed from a luxury to a necessity. In a moment, in a twinkling, it became something that wasn't just nice to have. You had to have it. Countries, nations fought over it. That's never been the case with diamonds.
Any chance we'll get gold from outer space?
Oh, absolutely. All we have to do is get the technology because it's out there. Hmm. In fact, NASA had a story. There was a story, at least, that some NASA astronomer identifying what resulted from this incredible collision of stars or blow-up or some kind of supernova. This was a story that appeared just in June. He said they'd analyzed the elements, and one of the productions of this explosion was 25 Earth-sized planets of solid gold. So it's out there.
Wow, I guess that would be a good justification for the money we spend on the space program.
Oh, you bet.
So you said you don't own gold. I mean, you don't own it as an investment. Do you have like a gold ring or a watch or something? And do you feel differently about it now that you know so much about the subject?
Well, I feel differently about gold. I'm entranced by gold. I think it's something that's romantic, deeply human. It says a lot about us. Certainly we have gold jewelry. My wife has a gold signet ring and a little gold bracelet. I don't have any gold myself. I had a pair of cufflinks when I was a much more showy dresser than I am now. But I gave them to my nephew when he graduated from law school. Hmm. So I thought, okay, here you can have these. He thought they were great. Hmm. But I think that gold, you know, on its website, Barrick Gold, one of the biggest gold mining company in the world, used to have, I don't think they have it there anymore, but they used to have a section on uses for gold, and one of them was
a medical thermometer. We're about to run out of time, and it is good for a medical thermometer at least.
It is, but I think what it really measures is the human race.
Hmm. The new book by journalist Matthew Hart is called Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. Matthew, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.